All right, I just updated the all the latest recordings onto YouTube and onto my website. So if anybody wanted to watch any of the recent classes, they are there. I have a YouTube channel, which I presume is easy to find, and then just and you can get to everything from my website, from the Zoom page. So it is July 25th, 2023, deep in the heart of summer, and many of you are probably in hot places. I live in the magical bubble called the Bay Area, where weather has been very nice. And so I feel a little guilty, but I'll be traveling to the East Coast to suffer along with all the East Coasters very soon. So you don't have to have too much envy. What else did I want to say? So, yeah, if you are on the East Coast, I am going to be in a variety of places, including Omega Institute in upstate New York for the 11th to the 13th of August, and then in Ithaca, New York on the 14th of August, and in Philadelphia on the 19th of August, and Maplewood, New Jersey on the 20th of August, and then Southern Dharma. So find me somewhere. Let's start with some sitting. And as usual, I will give just a bit of instruction, excuse me, and then we can just sit quietly for a little while. So, you know, so we begin with just settling the body, which is, I think of it as really a major part of meditation practice, just getting oriented, getting balanced, coming into stillness. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And turning the attention inward to the experience of the body, the experience of the mind. And just feeling the breath moving in the body. And you can use the breath as a kind of calming mechanism just to relax and release tension. So as we exhale, there's a sense of release. The inhalation is a kind of opening. Then there's this softening. And as we settle in, just noticing kind of mood and energies you bring to this period of quiet. So the physical energy, are you alert or drowsy? And then we might say more emotional, the energies of stress or anxiety. Or some heavier feelings. Sadness or fear. And of course, there can be pleasant feelings, lightness, brightness, joy, open-heartedness, And it's not unusual to have a mixture of pleasant and unpleasant, some neutral. The felt experience is dynamic, moving, changing, conditioned, complicated. So as we breathe with that, it's just a sense of allowing, not trying to control or direct our feelings. But allowing all this to just come and go. And just feeling the body breathing in, breathing out. And you can start to direct the attention a little more closely to the breath, feeling the sensations at the nostrils, or the feeling of movement in the belly, chest. So this gives us a concentration object, a focal point. And it's not that we're trying to block out anything else, but this just gives us a place to land. When the mind wanders or the energies sweep us away, when we wake up from that, we just come back to the simple experience of breathing. This is the uncomplicated experience, breathing in, breathing out. Can be helpful to just make a soft mental note with the breath. In, out. Or if you're following the breath at the chest or belly, rising, falling. Having some intentional words in the mind can help to just kind of hold off the other thoughts that arise, give the mind something to play with, something to do. It can be very revealing to see what thoughts kind of break through and capture our attention when we're trying to just be present. Typically, these are thoughts about our persistent concerns. They're often some variation on thoughts we've had before. They aren't original most of the time. So we see that the mind is just spinning, grasping at whatever shiny object appears and riding with that. It's not that our thoughts are these precious, unique items that must be explored. Many of them are simply recitations of familiar concerns that we can let go without any loss. And just seeing if you can find a simple pleasure in feeling and being with the breath, the flow of life moving through you. All right. There is something I wanted to mention, just remembered while we were sitting there in quiet there. This Saturday, which is July 29th, I'll be co-teaching on Zoom a kind of day-long, half-day retreat with Vimala Sara. It's at Spirit for Spirit Rock. I have it somewhere in all my open tabs, maybe. Anyway, I'll find that and put the link in. It's sort of an odd schedule because she's going to be in the UK and I'm going to be where I'm going to be. So it's going to be 9 o'clock on the West Coast, 9 to 2 o'clock. So East Coast, noon to five. It's called Freedom of Heart, Mindfulness Practices for Healing Addiction. We always have to come up with some kind of a name for these events. They're basically the same thing. Okay, here is a link. Oh goodness. There's a lot of coding in that link. Anyway, if you're interested, you can just go to the Spirit Rock website, spiritrock.org, and search for that, or just go through their calendar. Yes. So I feel like I'm seeing a couple of new names, but one never know. Well, I'm not sure. Since I don't do any kind of take role or anything. Maybe I should start taking role here, you know. In any case, welcome to everyone new and not so new. I mentioned at the beginning that I was going to go back to my workbook, which I haven't done in a while, actually. And so I'm going to start with a section called Developing a Practice, and I may go beyond that. We'll see how it goes. I find so many people have a difficult time just establishing a regular meditation practice, and as someone who's sort of very routine oriented, and you know, it's not a problem I've had very much. So my own suggestions, I don't know if they're that helpful. You know, one of my theories about teachers, and one of the things that I think I'd bring as a teacher, is that people who have a difficult time with things become better teachers because they've had to deal with the problem. You know, when you have a math teacher for whom math is really easy, they don't understand how to communicate to somebody who, like, it's really hard for me to understand quadratic equations. Can you explain that? Well, it's simple here. And you're like, no, what? Anyway, I'll do my best here. And if anybody else has suggestions, that'd be great. You know, because we talk about, well, I want to meditate. And then, you know, people read Dharma and maybe even go on retreats. But when it comes to just like meditating each day, that can be hard. And so here's the tips that I have in here. First one is set up a place in your home devoted to meditation. This can just be a corner of a room or a small extra space or alcove. Put your chair or meditation cushion in the corner and perhaps a small table with some special objects. It's called an altar. I didn't say that here, but having a space devoted to meditation acts as a reminder to practice and reinforces the practice when you sit there. You know, I I don't sit here when I meditate. I sit over there in the corner, and it's, yeah, there's nothing to distract me. I have a Buddha on the table and a couple of other objects that have meaning for me, and a bell. So when I sit there, there's like nothing else to do, right? It's not like, oh, I'll grab one of these books to read or something. Two is schedule meditation into your day. Before you go to bed at night, decide when you're going to meditate the next day. You might have to get up earlier or leave some gaps in your schedule. You can meditate on a break or at lunchtime at work. You can meditate before dinner. You can even meditate before bed, but that's not ideal. And the reason I say meditating before bed isn't ideal is because, you know, we tend to be tired at that time of day. So our, you know, we're going to tend to just get more sleepy. And that can actually kind of cultivate the habit of falling asleep when you're meditating. And I know a lot of people use, you know, meditation apps and things to fall asleep. So this actually is like a tricky little deal. I remember, you know, I have some guided meditations on Insight Timer. And I think soon after I put them up, I was scrolling through the comments, you know, and I think they encourage the teachers to respond to some of the comments. But I remember there was one comment that said, oh, this was a really nice meditation, but the bell at the end woke me up. And I was like, well, yeah, that's what we're trying to do is wake up. But I get, you know, and you see on Insight Timer, like, seems like half the guided meditations are like, help you fall asleep, help you relax, help you to, you know, get over insomnia. And so I don't really, meditating before bed is nice, but I wouldn't make that my main practice. But scheduling it into your day, I think, is really helpful, because, you know, if you have any kind of routine, it's like, well, I have to be at work at such and such a time. Okay, well, what am I, you know, I get up, to, you know, brush my teeth, I have my breakfast, whatever your morning routine is. Okay, can I add 20 minutes to that? Okay, three, commit to meditate every day, even if it's only for 1 minute. This commitment helps you sustain your practice. It reinforces the idea that consistency is the most important thing, not perfection. I think this is a really important idea as well, because it's easy to get into the idea, well, if I don't meditate for 20 minutes, if I don't meditate for an hour, whatever you think is like the amount you should do, that, then what's the point? You know, and yeah, there's a lot to be gained by, you know, sustained periods of sitting, but it's a lot like recovery. It's like, you know, I'll be like really sober for 5 days and then I'll just take a day off. It's like, yeah, no, that doesn't work very well. And there's something about it embedding the idea of mindfulness and having that be something that's remembered, that it kind of, you tend to remember to be mindful during the day when you meditate for a little while in the morning. Obviously, I like the morning as an ideal time, but it's not the only good time. Four, and the final suggestion here is, find a meditation group and or teacher. Nothing reinforces practice like regularly joining others to meditate. Just as with recovery, it's hard to do it alone. Take advantage of the support that's out there. And of course, now, you know, when I wrote this, or when I put this book together, you know, Recovery Dharma and the other Buddhist recovery groups were not nearly as prevalent as they are now. But that's certainly a great place to have your regular group sit. And you know, sitting together is a really interesting thing. Many people find that when they meditate with a group, they're more able to settle, and that it strengthens their concentration. And I do think that there can be a collective energy, whatever that is, if you believe in something like that. But I also think there's a kind of keeping you honest, having a group, it's like where you won't get up and stop before the bell rings, and you'll try to be more still maybe than you might if you're alone. Ideally, if there's a meditation teacher with a group, then that you can sit with once a week, then you're getting to hear some Dharma as well, and maybe having an exchange or questions with the teacher. So definitely groups are a real foundation for practice. I also will go back to this idea of from number three, and if you're looking at this with me, it's page 42, 41 and 42 in the Buddhism and the 12 Steps workbook. The idea of perfection, I think, easily slips in here too. It's like, you know, people will say, oh, my practice is really like slipping these days. I'm really not able to focus at all. And, you know, my response to that is that's normal. Like, not to get too much like, oh, well, if I meditate every day, it's just going to get better and better. It's going to get deeper and deeper. And it's like, no, you just like everything else. It goes through ups and downs. And just riding those ups and downs and just showing up is another thing that I find very, very supportive. Because it's, you know, it's life, right? It's the same thing as our lives, that we have bad days, we have good days, and things go well, things go not so well. And we just, as in recovery, we just show up no matter what. We're not judging our meditation. Is it worth meditating if it's not pleasant? Is it worth meditating if I spent the whole 20 minutes, the full 45 minutes thinking about stuff? Yes, it is. It's still valuable because of this commitment that it points to. One of the things that I've noticed over the years, because I usually go on a retreat every year, is that no matter how my meditation goes during the year, when I get to a retreat, I can feel how something has happened in that year, that something has deepened in my practice, that there is some sense of development and progress, even when it seems like I'm spaced out most of the time. So, okay. Maybe, I was going to go on, and I may, if there aren't some questions, I may go on to the attitudes of mindfulness part. But I thought maybe just to see if anybody has any comments or suggestions of their own or questions about really developing and sustaining a practice. So you can use the hand raising function, or you can just, if you want, just unmute and shout out.
I'll shout because that's what I do all the time.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Hey, you know, I think one thing that's really profound about this is, you know, in this comment number three, the commit to the meditation every day. For those people who are, you know, maybe musicians or athletes or whatever, yeah, the key thing is practice, 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 practice. And what you just mentioned is, like in recovery, we never give up. You never give up. And I can remember trying to meditate 20 years ago, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And 6 years ago, I started delving into it. And then after I read your book and met you and come to these weekly classes, if I don't sit for an hour in the morning, I get dysfunctional. I mean, I look so forward to my hour of quiet time, and I'm in my meditation studio, and this is where I come. This is my place to go. So I just would reinforce what you're saying is just practice, practice, practice. When I was drumming, rudiments, playing rudiments till you drive everybody crazy, playing guitar, you know, you just practice, practice, practice. Never give up because you will get good at it.
Yeah,
I promise you, you will get good at it if you just keep practicing. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And I think I'll just add to that, like, when you say get good at it, I think that's something that's worth delving into a little bit, because I think that a lot of times people think that getting good at meditation means that you get good at quieting your mind. And, you know, you can develop that capacity, that power. But to me, and generally I don't, you know, try to use good and bad in referring to meditation. And I know I'm not criticizing how you're talking about it. It's just a normal way of talking about it. But what I think getting good at meditation is that you are less disturbed. You become less disturbed by all the stuff that happens. Rather than quieting the mind, you're not disturbed by the unquiet mind. That to me is really the key transitional place where meditation becomes pleasant, because the things that, like, you were trying to control, or that, like, oh, I wish it wasn't noisy here, or I wish I didn't have these thoughts, or why do I have that pain in my knee, you know, that when you stop fighting all that, then there's this. That's when it feels like you're learning how to do it. And of course, that's also the insight of, you know, that points to the Four Noble Truths, that when we're the second truth, the cause of suffering is when we're grasping, when we're trying to change things from the way they are. And when we stop fighting, you know, which, you know, is also a line from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we ceased fighting anyone or anything, then it becomes much more pleasant. And it doesn't mean that anything has changed in terms of what's going on in your mind and body. It's just that your relationship to it has changed. You're not in conflict with it, which is so interesting, right? It's not that the world has changed, you know?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, because that was a poor choice of words, saying, well, you get really good at it, but it becomes easier and more pleasant, and you start to understand what meditation is about, that the mind is, the thoughts are going to come in, you know, and the thoughts are going to go out. And I thank you for clarifying that, because that's more like what I wanted to say, other than saying you get good at it. But thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I'm really glad you brought that up. And yeah, and you know, it's interesting. So I've been listening a lot, as I usually do, but lately a little bit more to Ajahn Amaro, who I'm going to just put his name in the chat, because you can actually, his talks now have been turned into a podcast. So if you listen to podcast, they're really easy to find now. Like I listen to him on Spotify. And he often then goes to this other place with meditation, where it is not just that we're letting things come and go, but then that we're kind of turning toward the observing part of the mind, the awareness itself. And this is, again, another kind of stage, I would say, in the progress of practice. Again, there still might be activity in the mind, and you know, and sense experience happening, hearing sounds, feeling things in the body, etc. But that's not what your orientation is. You're orienting instead towards just the part of the mind that's watching this, which is sometimes called the still point, or the observer, where there's nothing really going on there. That's just, so you're sort of resting, and it's very subtle. But when you get used to this, when you get used to just letting things come and go, then at a certain point, you're kind of able to go, okay, what is watching? Where is there something other than this? And it's just sort of, it's a very subtle sort of settling back and like, oh yeah, there's just like this hanging out energy. There's this just being here energy that's observing. So that's what I would say is like the place of moving forward in practice. It isn't quieting that there isn't anything else going on in the mind, but it's seeing that there's another way of relating to our experience. I hope that's clear enough. Damien, hello.
Hi. Yeah, it was really, I just found that really interesting the way that you linked mindfulness practice to the bits in the big book there about you know, other people not bothering you as much. And it made me really think about me sitting in meetings recently, AA meetings, and just boiling with rage and judgment at people and their sharing, and people sharing for too long, for 5 minutes, 10, you know, 15. Right. I mean, it happened to me last night. I thought it was the whole meeting. I was just so angry at the fact everyone was laughing at everything anyone said. And it was just like, oh. And then I just thought, when you said that, it's just perhaps, yeah, mindfulness practice might help me with that, in the sense that I will be able to, it's not going to stop the annoying people, or what, if they're annoying. But
you know, right.
But it's going to mean less to me in a way, or at least I won't interpret it as annoying, and I can just allow the voices to drone on, whatever it is, without it bothering me. And that's not to say that I don't get a lot from meetings, but it was really interesting that link you made to between mindfulness and the big book.
So, oh, good. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's a section, I think it's in One Breath at a Time, that's called something like meetings are meditation, which, and right, like, I mean, I don't know who hasn't had an experience like that in a meeting, like you're describing, like, you know, that there's always that, and especially if there's that one person who always shares. And yeah, the principle of, you know, of both mindfulness and recovery is that we look within at our own reactions rather than pointing the finger, right? And of course, it doesn't mean that people aren't annoying, because people are annoying. It's Jean-Paul Sartre, right? Hell is other people. But yeah. When we realize, like, well, I'm the one who's suffering here. And why am I suffering? I'm suffering because of my reaction to them. Can I alter my reaction to them? And I think, yeah, what I think you're pointing to is, or what I'm kind of hearing is the idea that, imagine that these other people are your own mind, and handle it the same way you handle your own mind in meditation. Like, oh, what do I do when those crazy thoughts go through? I let them go. I don't engage. So yeah, that's really great. Thank you. Thanks, Damien, and welcome.
If there, hi, Kevin. This is Kate.
Okay, great, great. Hi. Good. Hi, Kate.
Hi. It's Kate out in Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Right.
One of the things that I can speak to is the, I've been sitting with people in early recovery, and at their request. And one of the things that has come often in the last month or so is a comment around how they question, why is it so much easier for me to meditate when I'm with other people than it is for when I'm alone? And of course, you've already spoken to that. And I just want to reiterate that whole issue of that combined energy and the paying closer attention and not being distracted or allowing distraction to carry one away when they're when I'm by myself, of course, I experience what they experience too, which is that sort of that collective energy or collective presence, really, that comes from sitting together. And I have to say, it's just a wonderful thing to observe from my standpoint, as these young folks are starting to tune into their own energy and what they're capable of in a sit. And at a time when I'm, you know, moving through the grief of losing mom, it has been incredibly powerful for me to watch consistency and commitment unfold in their lives. They don't necessarily see it as consistency and commitment yet. However, we all know that that's exactly what it is. That's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I just thank you for your words and your writings. They guide more people than you could ever imagine. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah. Thanks, Kate. Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. So I'm going to kind of offer the other side of this a little bit, but just to, it's one of the things that, like, now that I think we can say the pandemic is behind us finally, it's interesting to me that people keep showing up for this, for my groups online. I'm like, why are you here? I mean, I'm delighted that people show up. I would really not like to do it at blank screen. It'd be pretty boring. But I think that's what it speaks to, is our longing to have connection and to be together in our practice, even if it's just virtually, as they call it. But I do also want to really put in a plug for sitting alone for a couple of reasons. First of all, there isn't always somebody around to sit with. So, you know, if you're waiting around or if you're only sitting when you can find a group, it's going to limit what you how often you can practice. But more important, I think, I also suggest to people that they, you know, after they understand and can kind of know the basics of meditation practice, that they let go of listening to a guided meditation every time. I mean, I think it's nice to listen to a guided meditation from time to time, but there's some power. Yeah, I mean, I consider it a power that's developed, and sense of independence, you know, and self-reliance that comes when we're able to have our own practice, and that we sit and we decide how long we're going to sit, and we, you know, we develop that discipline, all of that. I mean, these are challenging terms, you know, self-reliance and independence, and you know, our determination and discipline, but they're really, really valuable tools. You know, I feel a little bit like I'm a parent now, right? Like telling my kids, like, you should really learn, but it's just valuable, you know, and you know, even if it just means you start out like 5 minutes each day, I'm just going to sit alone and follow my breath. I'm just going to sit still with my eyes closed for 5 minutes. I'm just going to like not do anything for 5 minutes and be with my own energy. We can build on that and have something that we can rely on, because there's times, you know, like I think of the times that I've gone in for surgery, for instance, before they give me the drugs, when it's like, wow, this is intense. And I'm just like, I'm in a room waiting for the doctors, and I'm just sitting there alone, and I'm breathing. And it's like, I can just, yeah, I could be looking at my phone or something, but if I can just like breathe and be with myself in those circumstances, it makes it much easier and gives me a sense of okayness. So there's no doubt, like, sitting with groups is really valuable and precious. And I really recommend people, you know, work on developing their own independence as meditators. There's a real value in that as well. So that's my lecture for this morning. A few more minutes, and I will I'll start with the attitudes of mindfulness, and first to talk about this. This is something that I took very much the idea, particularly from Jon Kabat-Zinn, and I think, I'm not sure which book, maybe wherever you go, there you are. But I remember coming upon, these attitudes of mindfulness, and I kind of adapted them for recovery. And I may have tossed out one or two of the ones and exchanged them. But this is, I think this is a really interesting section of this book, of the workbook. It starts on page 42. There's a series of attitudes of mindfulness. And then I have several FAQs. So I'm going to go over all this in the coming days, because I think these are important things. But the first one, which I'll just talk about for a couple minutes before we go, is non-judging in the attitudes of mindfulness. And I'm not even going to read from it, because this is a topic that's, like, really dear to me and really important. And I might just take it up again on Friday, but just at least to start. One of the things that I learned early on in my practice, particularly, I think, from Joseph Goldstein, was to notice when my mind is judging. And so in the noting practice that's taught in the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition, we make a mental note of the thoughts we're having. And one of the notes that I learned to make is, like, what, judging, like noticing when I'm judging things. And that really opens up a lot. It first of all shows you how you get trapped in your own worldview, in your own belief system. And maybe this is the key part of it. Seeing that our own belief system is conditioned. It's not based on absolute truths, is, I think, one of the key insights of Buddhist meditation and of Buddhism, is to see that when I judge someone, it is very much a conditioned thing. And there is no truth or untruth in that judgment. It's just something that's conditioned. And the same is true, you know, for so many things. That's a good book. That's a good song. That's a good law, you know. And we start to see, like, wow, all of this is conditioned. And there's a whole lot of suffering that arises out of that conditioning. It traps us. It creates inner conflict. It creates outer conflict. You shouldn't be doing that. You know, when you're in a, you know, when you're married, like I am, you know, you're put up against your judgments all the time, right? Like, why are you doing it that way? You know, when you're living with someone, and the very, you know, simple things, you know, the way you wash the dishes, whatever, you know, just the way you make the bed, like, that's wrong, right? Like, we realize how we've got these ideas and beliefs that, and you know, you trace them back, you realize, oh, I got that from my parents or whatever, you know, or you're just your own preferences. And so this really opens up a huge door for reflection. And you know, one of the things I have not been doing lately that Julie T, has asked me to do often, is at the end of class, suggest a reflection for people. So since I'm thinking of it right now, and we're at the end of class, I'm going to suggest this as a reflection for you in today and the next few days. Notice your judgments. Just notice them. You don't have to blame yourself. You know, it's not your fault. You know, you don't have to change them, but just notice them and notice how conditioned they are. So, June, go ahead. Before we go, I will open
Kevin, it thanks. I think I understand what you mean when you say conditioned, that our judgments are conditioned. But could you expand on that a little bit?
It's a really good question.
Fill it in a little bit.
So there's this phrase, there's this term in Theravada Buddhism, Sankhara. It's things that are conditioned to things that have, generally everything in the ordinary, in our ordinary world that's not Nirvana is conditioned. That is to say, it's made up of more than one thing. But in the case of judgments, what I particularly mean is that generally as children, first of all, we are taught certain things. And that's one form of conditioning, right? We're taught to believe certain things. And as children, we don't have the discernment ability to distinguish between the correct or incorrect. We're just fed it, right? So you grow up, for instance, to be a racist, largely because you are taught racist ideas that they are true as a child, right? So you're conditioned to be a racist. Now, then, so that's one form of conditioning, just what you're taught and that you take in. Then another form of conditioning is that we each have preferences, you know, which are also conditioned, but let's not get into too much of the background of that, but like there's certain music, for instance, that you like, right? And so when you hear certain music and you go, that's good, you hear other music and you go, that's bad. And over time, that becomes a belief, part of your belief system. Certain things taste good to you. Like, I really can't stand the taste of beets, okay? So it becomes part of who you are, belief system. So instead of just saying, I don't care for beets, I say, beets are horrible. Beets taste terrible. But that's, right, that's a judgment, that's an opinion, but it's not a truth. Right. So it's conditioned. So all of these things are things that through multiple factors, they go from just being ideas into beliefs, into, you know, in our minds, realities. That's good. That's bad. You know, okay. Does that give you some idea? Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, well, John, thank you for supporting me. Beats really are horrible. Yes. So don't ever go to Ukraine, you know, you'll be in trouble. All right, dears, very nice to see you all. Thank you for your presence and your practice today. And notice your judgments.
And, I like beets.
Okay, good. I'm glad that somebody's standing up for beets. Yes.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right.
Have a beautiful
Blessings,
day.
Thanks, everyone. All right, take care. Bye-bye. I'll be back on Friday on my regular Zoom channel.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, Monica.
Thanks, Kevin. All right. Monica.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.